Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, October 20th, welcome, welcome, welcome to the show, friends. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Welcome back, CG.
So happy to be here.
So happy to have you. Little trivia for you. Did you know Trenton, New Jersey is the second biggest city along the Delaware River after Philadelphia?
I did not know that.
Now you do.
Now
but today,
I do.
For the purposes of this show, it's number one. It's the most important city along the Delaware because today we're going to try to figure out who is going to be the next governor of New Jersey, going to inhabit an office in that state capital. It's a really interesting race.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really tense race between Republican Jack Cittarelli and Democrat Mikey Sherrill. It's become a really nasty and personal race.
Yeah, and it's interfering with, you know, television because you see the commercials every single day,
multiple times a day. Which means there's money pouring into this race, which usually means it's close.
Yes.
So today we're going to talk about the New Jersey governor's race. If you haven't been following it, we will get you up to speed. If you have, we're going to dig deep into some analysis with a pair of New Jersey political pros, and we want to hear from you. What's at stake in the New Jersey governor's race? What do you think the outcome means for national politics? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, hello, drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, because a lot of folks, I mean, it's only a couple weeks away voting.
Couple weeks.
And I mean, people may not be paying attention, but this is your day. This is the day
actually
to get caught
Actually, 5
up.
Days out from, I believe, early in-person voting starting October 25th.
Countdown is real.
So yeah, we're going to start to see some votes roll in. And by November 4th, we should know who is going to be the next governor of New Jersey.
Yeah. And so we're going to go to our trio of news stories. And the top story is something you probably heard about. DNA analysis has confirmed that the body of a woman found over the weekend is that of 23-year-old Kaida Scott, who police say was kidnapped on October 4th. Scott's body was found in the woods near the now vacant Ada H.H. Lewis Middle School in East Germantown. And this morning, less than an hour ago, the Philadelphia DA's office held a press conference announcing new charges against alleged suspect, 21-year-old Keon King. These new charges include arson, causing a catastrophe, among other crimes, in connection with a stolen Hyundai Accent that had been burned. It had been recently recovered by authorities. By the way, Keon King had already been in custody in connection with kidnapping charges, both connected with Kaida Scott, as well as a previous incident. And by the way, here is Assistant District Attorney Ashley Tazinski. I'm mispronouncing her name. Tosilowski. I'm sorry about that. Discussing that vehicle. Here she is.
At the time last week, when investigators went to the location where the vehicle was burned, that vehicle was no longer there. It had already been towed, compacted, and was in a junkyard. This weekend, we recovered additional evidence, including video evidence that confirms that this vehicle, we believe, is the vehicle that Mr. Keon King used to move Ms. Scott.
And by the way, according to the DA's office, cell phone location evidence puts King at the middle school near the place where Scott's body was found. It also puts him at the location where the vehicle was set on fire. And I will also note that the DA's office and police were only able to find Scott's body because of tips from the public.
You mentioned earlier that Keon King is being recharged in connection to a prior kidnapping, and that has become the focus of a lot of attention, understandably, because those charges were dropped in the prior case because witnesses, according to the DA, witnesses failed to appear in court. But there's a lot of questions about whether the DA's office should have still pressed forward with that case because there was strong video evidence. Mm-hmm. There's also a lot of questions about how the bail was set in King's prior arrest and whether or not the DA should have fought for a higher bail after a judge lowered it. So those questions circulating right now at a very tense time. We'll keep our eyes on this investigation.
Definitely. We'll be watching this. To our second story.
Second story. This is an interesting one, Cherry. A new study published today in a major medical journal finds that the rate of allergies among U.S. children has dropped sharply, headlined by a 43% drop in peanut allergies specifically. We know peanut allergies, that's one of the big ones
for children.
This study was led by a CHOP researcher, David Hill. So why the sudden drop in allergies? Well, the leading explanation here, Cherry, is a change in official guidance. Prior to 2017, the federal government told parents to avoid giving their infants common allergens, like peanuts. Then, after some very important landmark research, they reversed the guidance to say that you should expose your young babies to peanuts and other common allergens. And they believe that this early exposure has helped reduce sharply the amount of allergies in young children. So some really important research on an emerging trend.
And that's a huge drop in peanut allergies. And that caused all food allergies to drop about 36%. And I don't know, Avi, if you remember, there was a time when it seemed like so many children were suffering from these allergies, the different food allergies. If you went to anything, you couldn't have this, you couldn't have that.
Yep.
And so this is a pretty big deal, because once you have one of these allergies, and the nut allergies can be really deadly and very dangerous, like 80% of the kids never grow out of it. So this can be a lifelong thing that could be very debilitating, and it could affect you for the rest of your life. So the fact that parents followed this guidance and we see this huge decrease is a pretty big deal.
That's the important thing, I think.
Yeah.
That parents followed the guidance, because what changed here is not the discovery that early exposure to allergens can be helpful. What changed is that the government said you should expose your kids to peanuts.
And they listened.
And parents seemingly have listened. We don't know for sure if that's the cause, right? But a lot of times in the media, we focus on the folks who disagree with official guidance or disagree with, quote unquote, the science. But this is a case that shows you that a lot of people still take these recommendations very seriously. And when doctors and government officials come forward with good evidence, people will change their behavior.
Yeah.
And I think it's an important lesson that sometimes the vocal minority is just that, a vocal minority.
Yeah.
The majority will follow good science if it's packaged in an appropriate way via recommendations from the government.
Yeah, and preventing a lot of allergies here. So
hopefully, yeah.
Yes, our third story, some sad news. Pioneering journalist Michael Days passed away suddenly over the weekend in Trenton, New Jersey. He was 72 years old. If you didn't know Michael, I'll tell you who he is. Michael was a former managing editor and executive at the Philadelphia Daily News, also at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he led the Daily News in 2010 when it won a Pulitzer Prize for investigative journalism. Days mentored countless journalists over the years and was known as a quiet yet fierce and forceful leader who was both wise and kind. He was an NABJ Hall of Famer, a former president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists, and he was the current president of NABJ Philadelphia. Tributes to Michael have been rolling in. His wife of more than 43 years, Angela Dodson, who is an author and a journalist, she told the Inquirer that people loved him. He commanded such respect that she used to say people would elect him president of anything. Mm. And this loss hurt me personally because I will say he was a friend of mine. I've known him for 15 years. We never worked together, but we got to know each other through PABJ. I'm also a former president of the organization. And I'll just say this, Avi, anytime I called Michael, he answered the phone and he would listen. He would give great advice, but he would also give tough advice if necessary. And this one hurts so many people. And I could just name all the folks who are impacted and who work with him and that absolutely loved him.
A Hall of Fame mentor, it sounds like.
Yes.
And that's such an important thing. And there was a quote in the obituary for Michael Days, a former colleague of his, saying that he was a 100th percentile human being.
Yep.
And if that isn't a quote we can't all strive for in our obituaries.
Just a classy, classy guy.
Yeah. And I guess I'm curious for your insights about what do you think made him such a great mentor to so many people? Because that's something that I know a lot of us struggle with, how to help others and sort of do it in the best way, the most instructive way possible.
Well, he just had this way of like encouraging you. Like if you read one of your great stories, he sent you a text.
Yeah.
You know, Stephanie Farr wrote that he used to give great sticky notes, great quote. And, you know, this can be a thankless job in journalism sometimes, and it can be really tough. And so having somebody that sees you, You know, Tremaine Lee was one of his interns, and now he's a national reporter, and they still have a great relationship decades later. So, yeah. I mean, just kind of shows, you know, what kind of man he was. He'll be missed.
My condolences to you and everyone who loved him. It sounds like an amazing guy.
Yeah, for sure.
So thanks for that tribute, Cherry. Pivoting now to our main topic today for the rest of the show, we want to know, what do you think is at stake in the upcoming New Jersey governor's race? And what do you think the outcome means for national politics? We'll be diving deep into this very contentious race between Jack Cittarelli and Mikey Sherrill. Get those thoughts in. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. New Jersey's funky off-year elections give the Garden State an interesting role in national politics. New Jersey governor's races always happen less than a year after a new presidential term has begun, and that means all the pundits look at the results as an early referendum on whoever is in the White House.
And that is no different this year. When the votes are counted on November 4th, we may get some clues on Donald Trump's popularity or lack thereof. But there's also a lot about this race that's specific to New Jersey. Its affordability issues, its bare-knuckle brand of politics, and the tendency of its voters to vacillate between parties.
All of that will help dictate the winner between Democratic Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill and former Republican Assemblyman Jack Cittarelli. And today, we're lucky to have a pair of Jersey political pros with us to break down the race. Ben Dworkin is founding director of Rowan University's Institute for Public Policy and Citizenship. Ben, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, and we also have Brent Johnson, political reporter in the State House Bureau of the Star-Ledger and NJ.com. Brent, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And what's at stake in the New Jersey governor's race? What do you guys think? What do you think the outcome means for national politics? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And so, Ben, Brent, we want to, if you were one of those folks who just popping their head out of the sand, they're finally paying attention to New Jersey politics, I want you to lay it out for us. Give us the lay of the land about what is at stake in this very contentious and expensive race for governor. And we'll start with you.
Sure. What's at stake is pretty much everything in New Jersey.
Everything.
Everything. The way the system has been set up since the modern Constitution of 1947 is that the governor is the bright sun of the political universe in New Jersey. The governor has tremendous power. Like in Pennsylvania, you elect an attorney general, could be from a different party. There's nobody else who's elected statewide besides the governor and then the lieutenant governor who runs on a ticket like we do at the national level.
Yeah.
So it's really, there's one person who can talk to everybody from Cape May up to Mahwah. And that is the governor. The governor has tremendous power to influence every piece of legislation, make all the appointments for all the boards, commissions, judges, etc. And so when we look to this governor's race or any governor's race in New Jersey, we're talking about who is going to define how New Jersey runs for the next 4 years. And we have an open seat because Phil Murphy is finishing up his two terms, and we have two very interesting, I'll just sort of end with this and turn it over to Brent. We have two really interesting historical interpretations.
Yeah.
New Jersey tends not to, first of all, we should all understand, as blue as New Jersey is when it comes to federal elections, like for U.S. Senate and president, it's very purple when it comes to gubernatorial elections.
Yeah.
Since the 1960s, New Jersey has not given a third straight term to one party to be in the governor's
seat. Incredible, which is just an incredible thing.
It's gone. So sometimes it's been one term, but it's always switched, never more than 8 years.
Which is crazy to think now. Pennsylvania is on a third term of a Democratic governor, and Pennsylvania is like the purplest of all the purple states. But yet somehow, when it comes to these governor's races, New Jersey just has this pattern of switching.
Wow.
But the other pattern that that makes Democrats excited is that whomever wins the White House the year before our governor's race, the party, the opposite party, tends to win.
It's the backlash election.
It's the backlash election. Yeah. And there's been one exception, which was 4 years ago. Biden got elected and then Democrat Phil Murphy got elected. I would suggest to everybody that that was a COVID election. Everybody got mail-in votes. It was a whole, it was a different thing, a little bit of an outlier. But we have to go back to the 80s to really see where that, you know, where that trend started. And so you've got these competing historical narratives
kind of
that
colliding.
Make each side really excited and thinking this is their year.
Okay, Brent, your take. What's at stake here?
A lot. I mean, it does seem to be a race that the national pundits are paying attention to and national politicians. So my wife keeps asking me about, you know, what's going on in the race, because even she's excited. She's someone who doesn't really care about politics. So there's just a sense that New Jersey is the center of the universe, right? The political universe right now. And, you know, again, as Ben said, it's going to determine how the state is governed over the next 4 years. And, you know, you could see a completely different New Jersey, no matter who is elected.
Yeah. So Sue comments, it's closer than it should be. I hope the New Jersey Democrats can get off their you-know-what and get Cheryl the votes that are out there. Clearly, at least according to Sue and some of the other stuff you see out there, Democrats are a little nervous about the chances of their nominee, Mikey Sherrill. So let's get into Mikey Sherrill. I just want to walk through her biography with you, Brent. Not from the state of New Jersey, right? She's grew up in the DMV, Virginia area.
Yep, Virginia, yep.
Went to the Naval Academy. We'll get back to that later. Law degree from Georgetown, then became was a naval helicopter pilot from 94 to 2003. Then she came to New Jersey, I guess, because she was working at a New York City law firm and then was at the state attorney, the prosecutor's office.
Yeah, prosecutor's office.
So that's her New Jersey link, I guess?
Yeah, she came here and then she ran for office and became a congresswoman from North Jersey. So kind of similar to Phil Murphy. Phil Murphy grew up in Massachusetts, came here when he worked for Goldman Sachs later in life. And she's been here now since 2010. So Murphy's been here since about 2000. But yeah, that's one of the criticisms Republicans use against her, is that you're not really Jersey, whereas Jack Cittarelli is a longtime New Jersey resident and native.
Now, on the positive side for her case, got elected to Congress in 2018, flipping this longtime GOP district, right? So she seems to have some appeal to moderates. And I take it in 2024, she did better in her district than Kamala Harris did and even Andy Kim did in that district. So it does seem like she has some crossover appeal.
Yeah, she's the kind of Democrat who is relatively moderate but has a very good bio. That's one thing you hear about her, is that her credentials are stellar. The question is she good on the stump? You know, is she good on her feet? And we did a piece today about how some Democrats are nervous that she's focused too much on Trump, that she's not aggressive enough, and that she's made too many gaffes. And you've seen that story. Other people report similar things, because that's the fear Democrats have, that after what happened last year, Trump greatly improved his margins against Harris in New Jersey. Harris won, but Trump, after having double-digit losses his first two times in New Jersey, only lost New Jersey by 6 points this time. So there's a lot of bedwetting going on
Democrats.
Democratic Party. Yep.
Okay, now Jack Cittarelli. Let's talk about Jack Cittarelli. We'll go now to you, Ben. Let's guide us through the bio of Jack Cittarelli. Now, unlike Cheryl, he's born and bred New Jersey, right?
Yeah, and if that matters to you as terms of how is your, what's going to drive your vote, then sure. He has been around, his family has been around, generations of Cittarellis, and so grew up here, independent businessman, and has gone through all levels of government, local.
Yeah, I saw he started in borough council in Raritan. I mean, so he's really worked his way up.
Yeah, he has. He's worked his way up. He was a state assemblyman, and then it was going to, he ended up sort of not running again, but he's gone through local, county, and obviously the state legislature. And for the last 10 years, he's been running for governor. I mean, I think that's one of the...
So this is his third run for governor, right? The first time he did not win the GOP nomination, right?
Then
he wins it in 2021 and does surprisingly well against Phil Murphy, uses that momentum to just demolish the GOP field this time around, and now he's in his third run. So does that help him? Does that hurt him? The idea of just sort of kind of being the perennial candidate. I can see that cutting both ways. What do you think?
I think it helps him much more than it hurts him. I'm sure there are some people who are a little bit tired of Jack Cittarelli, but I think it helps him, and it helps him in a couple different ways. New Jersey has a very unique media environment. Like a lot of states, we've seen our newspapers and political reporters sort of decimated, and there just isn't a lot of coverage. And we, fact is, we have to rely on both Philadelphia and New York major networks to cover what's happening here. So there's a lot of people who just don't know you for a long time if you're a politician. And traditionally, unless you were Bill Bradley, Chris Christie, or someone who were major personalities and people knew, or someone like a Phil Murphy who would just buy and could just spend tens of, or John Corzine previously, can spend tens of millions of dollars to get your name out there, people had to run more than once just to for everybody to know.
Hello, this is who I am.
And so you have a situation where Jack Cittarelli, who really hasn't been doing anything else, like he hasn't had an official title, other kind of service, for a decade has been running. And so this helps him as well. A, people know who he is. Mm-hmm. B, he has cultivated a tremendous amount of goodwill, particularly among Republicans. He's been to every local rubber chicken dinner for Republican
club. Shaking hands, kissing babies.
He has done that and pretty much exclusively that kind of stuff. But it also means he's really sharp on his feet. He's good at this. You know, his first year, made mistakes, goes back with his team, figures out the mistakes, comes back the second time in 2021. Made some mistakes, still loses, goes back, says, okay, I'm going to be better. We're looking at Jack 3.0. that is it. And you compare that to Mikey Sherrill, where this is, yes, she's had a competitive couple of races for Congress, but this is her first time running statewide. And Brent and I, who live this stuff, you know, for our jobs, will tell you, New Jersey, small as it is, compact as it is a very much of a wild jungle of a political environment. It takes a lot to understand that. So she's the new addition, but she's just coming out. And he is at a third, you know, level of really being sophisticated.
He's had a lot more practice running.
And that
for
helps
office.
Him because I think people see him and they're like, wow, he's sharper, doesn't use notes, all these kinds of things. Interesting.
And by the way, I want to remind our listeners, we would love for you to participate in the conversation. What's at stake in the New Jersey governor's race? What do you think the outcome means for national politics? The number again, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop those comments in the chat. And by the way, I want to kind of piggyback off of what you said, Ben, and throw this to you, Brent, because the New York Times sat down with a number of leaders in the Garden State. And some said they didn't like Cittarelli because he aligned with Trump. But all of them said that he got very specific on what he would do as far as state policies. And those that supported Mikey Sherrill, on the other hand, said that she had not fully articulated her vision. They were confused. They wanted more specificity. So I want to sort of talk through like some of the big issues and how the parties have differentiated themselves during this race.
One of the big things about this race is that Trump is considered the X factor. And you can kind of see that that cross type thing go on, because Cittarelli used to be a Trump critic when he ran the first time. Then last time he kind of sat on the fence on Trump, didn't seek his endorsement. And this time he got his endorsement, and he's been praising the president publicly. Cheryl has basically been saying, we're nuts if we elect Jack Cittarelli because he'll be a Trump supplicant. And, you know, that's a dangerous road to go down. But hanging over all this is that New Jersey is a very expensive state to live in. Taxes are always high, the highest in the nation. And you also have energy rates that have gone off the charts recently. So that kind of colors all of this. And you'll hear some Democrats tell Mikey Sherrill, focus more on affordability. Don't talk so much about Trump. Trump is important, but you got to focus on affordability. And Cittarelli's trying to say, like, yes, I know I'm connected to Trump, but I know how to lower your taxes. We don't want more of the same in New Jersey. So you see those themes really crisscrossing with each other and really playing out in this race. And, you know, basically, you know, that's something that no matter whether you stand with Donald Trump or not, the big thing is that everyone in New Jersey knows how expensive it is. And so that's kind of the overarching theme because of that.
Yeah. So there's politics, but then there's big issues.
No, affordability is clearly the big issue, which is why I think a lot of the negative ads that each side has and charges that each side has lobbed against the other haven't really resonated and become the dominant issue. People are like, I'm very focused on affordability. And as Brent said, it ranges. It's not just taxes. It's affordability in healthcare. It's affordability in energy and electricity costs. It's affordability in education, daycare, childcare. All of these things, just the general level of it's expensive and people feel strained. What is interesting, or I find interesting at least, is that the way Cheryl is talking about it, there are those Democrats. You see this in New York, in the mayor's race. There are those Democrats who are out there saying, we have to, you got to vote for me. We're standing up to Trump because he's a threat to democracy, that he's authoritarian, etc. She's not talking about that. She is talking about Trump, but she talks about him and blames him for part of the affordability crisis. Trump's tariffs are causing us hardship. Mm-hmm. Trump's H-1B visa is causing your family hardship because you can't get your brilliant cousin to be able to come join you in the States. Trump's policies on energy are costing New
Jersey.
It's
a different type of anti-Trump message.
Exactly.
Than perhaps what
and
people
it's,
have
so
come
it's
expect.
A Trump relates to affordability message, which is what she continues. She has been talking about it, and it takes a tremendous amount of discipline if you're a Democrat to sort of stay focused on that. But that's largely what they've been doing.
I know we're talking about politics this hour, but a little policy here, Brent. Like, what are their plans on affordability? Like, can we do a little side by side between Chitterelli and Cheryl about how they actually propose to lower costs for everyday New Jerseyans?
Well, let's talk about taxes, because New Jersey has the highest property taxes in the country. But taxes are levied at the local level, meaning by town. So she is proposing to merge more government, local government structures so that there's not as much tax burden. She is also saying she will make housing more affordable and would do some things with education funding. She also, energy rates have also gone up in New Jersey, and she is saying that she will freeze energy rates the moment she gets in office. That'll be her first emergency act. And then he is saying one that's not feasible. He instead is proposing pulling out of the regional greenhouse gas initiative and diversifying energy in the state. He is also saying that he has a multi-pronged tax plan to overhaul tax brackets in New Jersey, and he would also redo school funding, which is school funding is the largest bit of that goes into your property taxes. And the question is whether he would actually whether any of those plans work, too, because Democrats will tell you that he's trying to be everything to everybody. And his plan's also not feasible. So they both do have plans. The question is whether there's enough detail and whether they're actually feasible.
Yeah.
So we let's read a few comments here because MJ says Chitterelli is a Trump protege. If you like Trump, go ahead. John from Lakewood said Cheryl does not reach out to the Jewish community. Chitterelli, on the other hand, does a great job appealing to the Jewish community. He has got our vote. I guess John's speaking for all Jewish people there in New Jersey. I'm not quite sure. But, you know, so speaking of let's I guess maybe lay out like what a path to victory might look like for Chitterelli or Cheryl. Like if I say to you, Ben, why will Cheryl win? What would be your explanation for if we're sitting here on November 5th looking back?
I think one of the first things that we'll be looking at to understand a Cheryl victory is turnout. We get about 40% turnout on average in New Jersey. And that can go from 37 to 40. Mm-hmm. The closer it is to 40 or more in terms of, and first of all, let's lament the fact that 60% of the people are not voting for governor when, gosh, they should. Mm-hmm. But the higher that number goes, the better it is for Democrats. Democrats have a significant advantage.
I think that's still true, though. I feel like people feel like that's starting to switch a little bit
within the
Trump era. But you still feel like higher turnout good for Democrats in this type of race.
Yes, absolutely. Because the people who are coming out are more marginal Democrats who might be staying home. There are just more of them. And it helps if more people come out. If we have a lower turnout, then it's, I think, a big significant help to Chitterelli. So that would be the first factor
that you would look at.
I would look at. But we should just understand, you know, there's a rhetorical question people like me in political science throw around to each other, which is, how heavy is the straw that breaks the camel's back? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, it's as heavy as every other straw. There's never one thing.
Yeah.
The point. There's a lot of different things. So somebody wins by 2 points, yeah. somebody loses by 2 points, which is eminently possible in this race. We're going to look at a host of things, whether it's, she didn't reach out to this community,
right.
or she
right.
made a flub, or he tied himself too closely to this person, or didn't respond. It's going to be a lot of different things, but I think turnout is something we're going to look at right away, and it should give us an indication of who pulls this out.
And by the way, we have a caller on the line. We have Terry from Camden on the phone. Terry, you're on Studio 2. What do you think's at stake? Give us your take.
What's at stake? Everything's at stake because we can't. I'm a Democrat. I'm a registered Democrat. I'm a mail-in voter. My vote's in the mail already. I would not vote for Jack Chitarelli because he definitely is a Trump supporter. I think the condition of our country is in shambles because of all the Trump supporters. We need somebody and people all over this country who start to stand up for the rule of law and democracy. And this is not happening. So the more we've seen what a Republican Congress and what a Republican Senate has done, which is virtually stopped everything and just is bowing down to the king here. Mm-hmm. So I don't want a governor who's a loyal subject to the president. I want a governor who's going to fight for New Jersey and the rule of law.
Yeah.
Thank you, Terry.
That's Terry from Camden. By the way, if you want to participate in the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. You can give us your take at what is at stake and the New Jersey governor's race. I wanted to sort of talk about what moves the needle a little bit, because we saw in polling, Sherrill's support from women far outpaces Chitarelli's support for men. And so can you talk about the polling? It's pretty tight, although there is a pretty big swing depending on who you ask, Brent.
Yeah, I mean, polls, I was just talking about this with Ben heading into this interview. Polling has pretty much shown that she's in front the entire time. There hasn't been a single public poll that has shown him in front of her. There was one that showed them tied a few weeks ago from Emerson College. But polling has shown she's in front by single digits. Now, the question is, how much is the single digits? Some show 3, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. The high end seems to be that she's leading by 7. And he has not cracked 46% in any poll, which is would you know, stand to judge that you have to get above that if you really want to make inroads and win. So the polling has been tight and relatively much tighter than past governor's races in the last decade or so in New Jersey, which gives Republicans hope and gives Democrats pause. But again, she's led in everything so far, so you have to pin her as the front runner.
Yeah, let's look at most recent mm-hmm. Fairleigh Dickinson University poll. Sherrill plus 7. There was a plus 1, a plus 5, a plus 6. You mentioned that even recently. Mm-hmm. Then a plus 6, a plus 8, a plus 2, a plus 8. We're about to go to a break, but real quick, I mean, from the national perspective, Ben, what do you think would be viewed as a good result for Democrats in this type of race, given all the factors on the ground? Like, if they just win by a few points like they did 4 years ago, is that make them feel okay, or does that make them feel like, oh boy, maybe Trump's a little more popular than we thought?
It'll make Democrats, if Mikey Sherrill wins by a couple points, it'll make Democrats feel so much better than if she loses by a couple points.
Sure.
They're like,
that
a win is a win.
Yeah. A win
but
is
that's
a win
not often what people might say in New Jersey. They might say, if I'm a national Democrat, I expect to win by 8, by 10 in New Jersey.
And
but
I
you're
think,
saying that's not where their head's at right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, and I think that's just, honestly, people who don't know New Jersey.
Yeah,
New Jersey, again, very purple when it comes to governor's races. And people outside who just see it, presidential races, hey, it's really blue and it's called right away.
Right.
They just don't understand how state politics works here. There is an entire industry dedicated to interpreting how this election,
sure.
you know, what the national implications are. And so it doesn't matter whether you win by one vote, 1%, or 12%. It's all going to be spun because somebody's getting paid to do that on both sides.
Well, we will talk more about that on the other side of this break, and we'll talk about some of the huge controversies
yes.
in this race. And they are major. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. The New Jersey election is almost 2 weeks away on November 4th, and early voting starts in a week. The governor's race has been a heated one with attack ads blanketing the airways and fiery exchanges at debates and making big news. We'll talk about that in a second. We're talking about the candidates, former state assemblyman Jack Cittarelli and Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill, the polls, the issues, the ads, and how President Trump is factoring into the race.
And let me reintroduce our guests. We have Ben Dworkin, founding director of Rowan University's Institute for Public Policy and Citizenship, and Brent Johnson, a political reporter in the State House Bureau of the Star-Ledger and NJ.com. And our question for you, our listeners: what's at stake in the New Jersey governor's race? And what do you think the outcome means for national politics? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, share the video. But also leave a comment in the chat.
Well, Brent, if the gloves were ever on in this race, they're definitely off now. You had a quote from an anonymous political insider after the second debate. And this is someone who's not affiliated with either party. And the person said to you, quote, "You could tell they hate each other."
Yeah. Mm.
Good Lord. Yeah. So what has created all the animosity in this race? We have a couple ads queued up, but I just want to get a little sort of lay of the land why there seems to be such personal dislike at this point in the race.
Well, the two overreaching things are, one, that this is what politics have become in the last decade. Mm. Since, I'll tell you, I was just talking to Ben about how the 2017 race, when Murphy ran against Kim Guadagno and was elected to the governorship, it seems quaint now, looking back at some of those debates and those ads. Yeah. And things have changed a lot in the last decade. And the other thing is that it's an open seat. So just the contours of the race make it very heated in general, because they're both going after something that they both think is attainable. And just it seems that because of all those contours and things, they just don't seem to like, you know, these attacks that have gotten really personal. And I don't know if there's more behind it other than it's just that heated of a race. But there's a lot to keep track of. It's a fascinating race.
Yeah, I want to play this ad from the Sherrill campaign about Cittarelli that clearly got under the skin of Cittarelli. Let's roll that clip right now.
You're already struggling to pay the bills. Now imagine a 10% tax on groceries, clothes, school supplies, 10% on everything you buy. That's what Jack Cittarelli is talking about for New Jersey.
The 10% sales tax on everything, including food and clothing.
The same Cittarelli who voted to raise property taxes and wrote a plan that could have raised income taxes.
The 10% sales tax on everything.
High tax Jack. If he's governor, it's going to cost you.
High tax Jack.
Wow.
Okay, so Cittarelli is basically saying this is taken completely out of context, right, Brent? I mean, what is the truth behind high tax Jack? By the way, a line of attack that Sherrill is clearly not letting up on.
Yeah, it's taxes, as we said, is a very important are a very important thing in New Jersey. And this is one of several situations in this race where some things have been taken out of context and selectively edited, and we've had to fact check. I've had to do three different fact checks in this race that I normally wouldn't have to devote that much time to because there's been so much confusion. He said at a rally that he was talking about Tennessee not having a sales tax and having
not having an income tax, and then but having a 10% sales,
10%
tax.
Sales tax. And he was talking about that, and he said everything has to be on the table in New Jersey.
Not saying I will do that in New Jersey, but here's another state that does it differently.
It's a possibility. Throwing it out there.
Yeah.
And so she took that quote and ran with it in her campaign and said, look, you have to be worried that that's on the table. And he has said multiple times since then, a sales tax increase is not on the table. Higher taxes are not going to happen under my administration. He's tried to make that clear. But once that's in the water, you know, I see, and when I do videos on social media, I see the response like, yeah, but he's going to make taxes 10% more. Mm-hmm. And he did it with her on energy costs.
Let's play that clip. This is an ad from the Cittarelli campaign that takes a clip from something Sherrill said a while ago. Let's play this ad from the Cittarelli campaign.
We need to move into clean power. It's going to cost you an arm and a leg, but if you're a good person, you'll do it.
Unbelievable. Talk about out of touch. I'm Jack Cittarelli. Politicians like Mikey Sherrill and Phil Murphy just don't get it. They're making New Jersey unaffordable, especially for the middle class. We need a change. My plan brings down property taxes, lowers electricity bills, and cuts your income taxes. Because you should keep more of what you earn. It's time to fix New Jersey. When I'm governor, we will.
wait a second, I'm the low tax guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, and then so I think she's particularly upset about that quote about clean energy costing you an arm and a leg. So what's the truth behind that particular cut?
So she was giving an interview on a podcast or internet radio. But either way, she was talking about how messaging for Democrats has been difficult on this subject, that they have tried to say like, oh, this is going to cost you an arm and a leg, but you're going to do it if you're a good person. But costs have decreased and that Democrats need to do a better job talking about it. So in the context, she wasn't endorsing that. In fact, she was criticizing it and trying to make the opposite point. But, you know, in today's day and age, when short sound clips are cut up, that's what happens. So, yeah, that's another one I did a fact check on. And it goes to show there are accusations flying from both ends. And if I'm a voter, I'm trying to keep track of all this. And sometimes those sound bites hold more power than the truth.
Yeah, and I want to bring up another controversy, Ben, that came out of the recent debate that they had, and things got really testy, and now there's threats of lawsuit. And I'm talking about the claim that Cheryl made that a firm once owned by Jack Cittarelli, Galen Publishing, was paid by opioid companies to produce educational material that downplayed the dangers of opioids. Cheryl has also accused that company of developing an app so that people could more easily get the opioids once they were addicted. Can you explain this controversy, how Cheryl has weaponized that, and now the threats that Cittarelli is making in response?
Well, the threats, what happened in that second debate was that Mikey Cheryl did not say, you have the blood of all these opioid victims on your hands because you took blood money from opioid companies who paid for certain research, which ended up in your publications that your company was producing. She said, you killed 10,000 people, thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
And she said it twice. So it was not a particularly subtle attack. It wasn't nuanced. You heard in some of these commercials that you just played, he's talking about, you know, they didn't say he will. They were caging in the words. And so you have this situation. Jack Cittarelli had a publishing company and he produced magazines and newsletters. And a lot of them were connected to universities that ended up taking funding from certain companies, any number of different companies, including those that made opioids, in which you could find a line at the time saying, hey, this stuff is not dangerous for addiction. And she's holding him responsible for the things that were published in the magazines that he was paid to do it. I think the bottom line here is that it's not going to make a difference.
Yeah.
I just don't see it. I mean, as Brent,
affordability, Trump just
it
just
is affordability, and to a lesser degree, Trump, and even that is still connected to affordability.
Yeah,
it's affordability. This kind of stuff, I just don't see. We've seen three polls that came out last week, all in the aftermath of the second debate. She is ahead by 5 to 7 points in every one of them. I just don't see any of this
not moving the needle.
Really so, making a difference.
So voters are not paying attention to any of these.
I wouldn't say that they're not paying attention, but I would certainly say they don't care enough about
it's not swinging their votes.
It's not what they're, it's not driving their decision making.
Joe from Pensacon says, Cittarelli is running a Superman campaign like Trump did, and I really don't believe him. Plus, this is too important an election to trust a Republican aligning himself with Trump. That's Joe's take. Mm-hmm. Let's get another call in, because Mary from Northwest Philly is going to draw our attention, I believe, to another controversy in this race that we haven't talked about yet. Mary from Northwest Philly, you are on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Gee, thanks. Yeah, I'm just amazed you haven't brought it up, the fact that some, like, dirty tricksters, basically Trump people, released her military records, which is supposed to be totally private secret information.
Yep. So let's backtrack a little bit.
Open that up, please.
Yeah, we're going to talk about
Mary
that right now.
Up. Mary,
thank you for teeing
it up,
Mary. So these are it's an unredacted version of her records while in the Navy that was released by the National Archives. I believe the official explanation is it was a mistake by a bureaucrat in the federal government.
Yes.
Cheryl is saying, this is no mistake. This is Trump and his cronies weaponizing the federal government. Now, what's interesting here, Brent, from my understanding, is that there wasn't anything there. Now, there was personal information that should not have been released, but nothing about her record in these records that was all that incriminating or or even negative. So it's more, I guess, about the principle of releasing them than what was in them.
To her, yes.
Yeah.
This has been one of the more difficult things to try and explain to people. Mm-hmm. I even sat down with someone in my personal life and was trying to say, hey, this is what happened. So long story short, Jack Cittarelli's campaign had been trying to find information about whether she was connected to a famous cheating scandal at the U.S. Naval Academy in the 1990s. A bunch of midshipmen cheated on a test and got kicked out. And so they were trying to find this information. So they had a surrogate on their behalf filed a Freedom of Information Act to try and get information to see what they could find about it. What they got was a nearly completely unredacted military file on Cheryl, including her social security number, her parents' address, and all kinds of things. And it didn't have any information about the cheating scandal, which is what Cittarelli's people say. And so they didn't use it. Instead, they found a yearbook and a commencement program that showed she didn't walk in her Naval Academy graduation because she admitted, I didn't walk because I did not turn in fellow classmates. And they're saying, well, there has to be more than that. You know, release your full file, show us. But they are saying she's been conflating this whole thing to draw attention away from the fact that she didn't walk in graduation and whatever connection she had to the cheating scandal. She is saying, whoa, 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 the more important thing here is that my files got released and every veteran's files is now at risk and Trump is weaponizing the government. So it's this big mishmash of something that she has made a very key part of her campaign is that she is a former Navy helicopter pilot and they're trying to weaponize it against her. Some people are saying this is an example of swift voting.
Yeah, but I say it sounds remember. Like the Kerry thing.
Yeah, John Kerry. So yep. That's also faded into the background because that dominated the conversation for like 10 days and I was trying to put it in simplest forms for readers to understand. But that's also, you don't hear, is that talked about as much either. So this campaign just has a lot of haymakers thrown into it that don't really last. And then we're right back to what we're talking about, Trump and affordability.
And I got to mention the fact that Democrats and Republicans, they're rolling out the heavy hitters for both of their candidates. I mean, Mikey Sherrill recently got an endorsement from former President Barack Obama. She's appearing alongside Maryland Governor Wes Moore, Michigan's Gretchen Whitmer, campaigning with Amy Klobuchar, former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. I mean, they're throwing everybody. And on the other side, you got all sorts of people stepping in, you know, for Cittarelli. The president may even speak on televised or, I guess, telephone town halls. Talk about just sort of the national, efforts here in this local race and what that
one means. One more. Yeah. Your governor, Josh Shapiro, is going to campaign for her on Saturday.
Oh, there you go.
Yep.
So what does all this mean when you see the national party sort of paying a lot of attention? They didn't necessarily, especially on the Republican side, do that a few years ago.
Well, yeah. First of all, both sides, again, think they can win.
Yep.
And therefore, everyone's going to do everything they can because no one wants to be on the short end of a tight, tight campaign. Second of all, it's about turnout. It is about 40% of the people will probably vote. And if you can make that 45%, 47%, it's going to make a huge difference. And so everybody is doing what they can because the people who show up are going to determine who is going to be the next in this tremendously powerful position of governor. And so at this point where they're all talking about affordability, the negative ads from the outside, the exogenous negative ads about cheating and about opioids have not really landed. People want to talk about this. So they're trying to, how do we drive up? This person is popular. This person has a following. Let's bring them in. Let's tie ourselves to that. It's all about generating turnout.
And I want to follow up with that with you, Brent, on the turnout issue, because minority voters, 4 out of 10 are Black or Latino in New Jersey. How are they? Are they, you know, how is Mikey Sherrill doing in this group? How is Cittarelli doing? You know, will Trump, you know, voters show up when he's not on the ballot? Can you talk about how they're working to sort of generate excitement so that people will come out on election?
Minority voters especially are considered a very big voting bloc, not just in New Jersey, but in this race in particular. I've written about this a few times. The thought is that Black and Latino voters shifted towards Trump last year. You saw that in very blue parts of New Jersey, like Passaic and Hudson County, that all of a sudden they didn't show up for Harris and some even voted for Trump. And Republicans are hoping the same thing happens this year. Cittarelli has been going to Black churches and speaking to Latino groups and trying to drive up that, make the same thing happen again that happened last year. And she has been doing the same. You've seen her campaign with Newark Mayor Raz Baraka, Westmore, Maryland's governor, trying to drive up what should be traditionally Democratic voting blocks, but haven't been as much in recent years. And there, I did a piece a few months ago about how black women in particular felt like they couldn't connect with Cheryl. And she went to Trenton and tried to speak with them and get them on her side. And that's been a dynamic we're also watching. How do those voters come out, and how does that drum out turn out?
Real quick, as we wrap up, we haven't even mentioned the legislature, but I mean, Democrats hold solid majorities in both chambers of the legislature, Ben. Any sense that that could flip this time around, or is that kind of just back burner stuff?
No.
Yeah.
The easiest answer I have for you today is that the legislature is going to remain in Democratic hands.
Yeah.
There are 40 legislative districts in New Jersey, of which each elects two members to the General Assembly. So there's 80 seats at stake.
And then one to the Senate. Yeah.
But the Senate isn't up this year.
Yeah, that's and the Senate's not
so
up
it's
this
only
year.
These 80 seats. But when we look at those 40 legislative districts, 35 are safely in the hands of one party or the other.
Yeah.
There are five we're really looking at, and that's not, even if one side gets them all, even if the Republicans sweeps them all, they're still not going to be
control. Doesn't change
control.
Yeah. All right. Well, we had to at least mention it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There are other elections.
Should be voting.
Absolutely. Ben Dworkin, founding director of Rowan University's Institute for Public Policy and Citizenship. Ben, always a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much.
And same to you, Brent Johnson, political reporter in the State House Bureau of the Star Ledger and NJ.com. Appreciate your insights this hour.
Thank you.
And thank you to everybody who called in and those of you who left comments. And of course, thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for joining us.
I'm Avi. Talk to you tomorrow.